I'm here to talk about DLSIG project that's just getting started. It's either variously called Towards Better Radiology Physics or the Future of DL Physics, so quite a broad remit. However, despite the fact this is an IPEM logo, I've been funded to come here by my trust, not by IPEM and DLSIG, so I'm slightly unshackled in that I'm not speaking officially on behalf of DLSIG. So what I'm going to say for the next 15, 20 minutes is going to be my personal professional view as a jobbing MPE at the Royal Free, but feeding into the DLSIG project. I don't have any slides because they would just be the words that I'm saying to you projected behind me, which I find really uncomfortable. If you want to go and read something, there's a scope article that was published fairly recently that goes through most of what I'm going to say this afternoon. There's also a webinar at the end of the week where we're going to take it a little bit further about the next steps. So we've got lots and lots of, you're all DR physicists? Was there like one MR physicist? Anybody that's not a DR physicist in the room? Right. All the DR physicists, I think you're doing it wrong. That's not meant to be an insult. I'm a DR physicist, I'm a DR MPE. I'm doing it wrong as well. And the stupid thing is that we know we're doing it wrong because I've had conversations over years with multiple people, including several in this room, about all the things that we know that we're doing that we think are pointless and all the things that we would like to be doing that we don't because we don't have time. So, over the past 20 years, Debbie's already talked about the change in technology. We've moved from, when I started in this job, film in general X-ray, where the picture you got was the picture that you got, and you couldn't do anything with it except stick it on a light box. Now we've got AI denoising and nonlinear filters and stent enhancement and all sorts of crazy things, such that the picture has never been further away from the physics than it is now, and we've just not changed and adapted to keep up with that. And so, what I'm going to try and set out for you is a bit of a vision of what DL physics could be in the future. So we're not there now, we're aiming towards it. These are my words, and the scope articles were my words, but it's not my vision. As I said, I've been talking to people over several years at meetings like this, at regional physics meetings with friends, colleagues, you name it. And I've tried to collect those thoughts from those people from multiple years and dozens of people and try and weave it together into something reasonably coherent that we can maybe set out as a roadmap for where we want to go to, and then we can think about how we get there. So to start with, we need to go right back to the very, very beginning and think about what's DR physics for, what we're trying to do, before we start thinking about whether we're doing a good job and whether we want to change anything that we do. Well, broadly, I think you can put that into three sort of categories. I mean, it's all about protecting the patient, really. But there are three big areas that we work in that I think are really important. The first one is making sure we detect things that go wrong with the equipment before it hurts people. Okay, that's what our QA program is all about. That is a big chunk of what's required, what we need to do. We need to keep that in mind. There's also about making sure that the clinical guys get the images that they need, nice, pretty pictures that they can see what they want. And that's all your sort of optimization bit tied in with that. And then there's supporting radiology to deal with things when they go wrong, beyond just the equipment, identifying errors, mistakes, finding those training problems and sort of filling those, help them fill those gaps and improve their service and deliver a really good quality radiology service. That's what we're for clinically. Ultimately, we're trying to make sure that they get nice pictures without too much radiation so that the patients get what they need. And so in order to do those things, there are four areas that I want to go through that I think we need to change how we work in order to deliver effectively. And that would be QA, which is a big one, and Debbie's already talked about some of the challenges there. Dose audits and what we do with the dose data that we've got. Image quality and engagement and who we're speaking to. So we'll take them each in turn. If we start with the QA, Debbie's already mentioned some of the changes that are coming with IPEM 91. The historic way that IPEM does documents is to wait 20 years, look back at the old draft, try and update it with what's been published and evidenced. And as Debbie's already said, we don't have evidence for some of the changes that we might think that we want to do, but there's nothing there. Who in the audience has suspended a unit at an annual routine QA? Right. My question to you with your hands up, rhetorical, don't shout at me. Why did it take until an annual QA before you detected that problem? And to those with your hands down, why are you doing annual QA then if you're never taking equipment out of use? What's annual QA actually delivering on our expectations of patient safety? But maybe what's QA for? So yes, it's about detecting faults with the equipment so we can protect patients. It's also about getting to know the equipment so we can make sure we understand how it works when we want to optimize it. And it might be about sticking our faces in front of people in the departments. And is our QA program as it's set up with annual physics QA and the IPM Type A user tests really delivering on those aims? I certainly don't get enough time with new equipment to fully understand it. And Deborah's already said there's a push to try and get more time acceptance and commissioning and do that properly. Who in the audience is doing daily QA or getting the radiologists to do daily QA on their equipment? We've got a few now. Right, is that on DR equipment as well, possibly? Is IPM 91's possibly now already behind where we want to be because we don't have that published evidence to back this up. Right. If you sit out and say, okay, what is a QA program that looks good and is actually going to protect the patients from harm, and we throw away the preconceptions about this annual physics QA and then the weekly and monthly radiography QA that we know doesn't work because it doesn't fit with their rotors and things, then actually I think you design something quite different. You have a daily functional check to make sure the equipment is not doing something horrible, and that detects things like your filters that don't work in your interventional room before they've got a patient on the table. That's a real example, we've had that one. You then might need, if you're relying on your DAT meter or whatever as part of your daily functional check, you might need some more regular tests by someone from physics or wherever to make sure that DAT meter's not gone to nonsense. And then I really question whether you need the annual tests as well. If you've got really robust daily tests to find the major things, are those annual tests actually finding things that really genuinely matter? There's been some work in South Sweden where they're just validating the annual tests done by the engineers to IEC standards and saying, yep, that's fine, we don't need to repeat all of those. And I wonder whether a good QA program for physics actually needs big lots of annual tests, especially at the expense of the radiographer tests, which in too many places, trying to follow the old IPM 91, just weren't working at all. So what do we need to progress to a very different world for QA? Well, we need evidence. So those of you that are doing daily QA, we need to collate and share that evidence that finds things that matters, so that the next IPM 91 that Debbie's forced to write before she retires has got all of that in there and says, you don't need to do all these physics tests because the radiography QA is really good and it finds stuff. We'll need a protocol that lays out what those tests should look like, and that might be multiple steps with user QA that's got the daily stuff and then some physics sort of intervening QA to make sure that daily stuff isn't nonsense, but an agreed protocol. We're moving there very, very slowly, but we could move an awful lot quicker. And we need to automate some of it as well. There was a lovely webinar the other week about automating QA, and we can get so much more out of stuff so much faster. But QA is not the be-all and end-all. We've got our dose audits as well. Again, when I started this job, they were still doing bits and pieces on paper or maybe on RIS. We've now got RIS, you've got your electronic patient records, you might have a dose management system, and if you don't have one, you need to scream at people till you get one. But we've now got thousands and thousands and thousands of data points that tell us what's happening in our rooms. And we have had an innovation in dose audits. Instead of using the mean, we now use the median, right? So if you've got 6,000 chest x-rays in your room, how many of those data points are you using to characterize it? One, the middle one. And all the rest of them go in the bin, and you don't worry about it, because DRLs are something that you stick on the wall and then forget about. We've got so much more data available to us than we've ever had before. We should be looking at the big patients, the small patients, the weird patients, the strange things that are going on. We shouldn't just be worried about setting a typical average dose for a typical average person, because almost none of the patients are typical and average. We should be looking at what we can do to improve that. So we're looking at big data sets, we're doing weird things, we're trying to look at whole distributions. We need some help. We're physicists, we're very good at thinking that we know everything and going away and trying to teach ourselves things. There's a whole profession out there whose job it is to understand lots of big numbers and things. They're statisticians, and we don't talk to them. And when I asked the question a few years ago to the IPM 88 rewrite group about whether they had a statistician on the group, they didn't. So that's a question. Why don't we engage with stats? We could get lots of advice, and in fact I've spoken to one, I've got lots of useful advice about other things we could do with this data. We also need to do dose audits more quickly. I know there's upcoming recommendations to do them maybe annually instead of three yearly. But if you write the right scripts and bits of software, you can get through them very, very fast, no longer spending days messing about with Excel. And we should be developing those together as a community, not just letting people write them and then someone else write the exact same thing almost somewhere else. I know there are people working on those, and we should be sharing those, but in a structured way. Because what we can't do is what we've done so far, which is someone writes it, shares it, no one else contributes anything, that person gets promoted, and then it dies a death. It needs to be done in a proper collaborative way. And we also need better ways to detect the weird things that are going on in the data. Right? We had a CQC reportable incident where a group of junior radiologists were using too high frame rates and too many frames. Your medians would not find that because they were a little cluster up at the top and didn't move the middle very much. But if you look at the data properly, the weird things, the unusual stuff, is telling you when things are going wrong that we need to fix, and that we can help radiology deliver a better service. And they're your first indication that your equipment is going wrong as well. So we need to be thinking about engaging with our clinical scientific computing colleagues, looking at ways of identifying odd stuff, clustering, machine learning, to find the weird things that are going on. But the dose and the equipment performance doesn't really matter if we don't worry about image quality. And clinical image quality is a difficult area. If you ask a radiologist to tell you what's a good image and a bad image, you will find that even they struggle with the idea of what's good and bad. The good news is that we don't need to know what's good and bad. We only need to know what's better and worse. And as soon as you can say, room one's better than rooms two, or that group of patients get worse images than this group of patients, then you can start looking at things that you might want to fiddle with and you might want to tweak. So what really matters is setting image quality that's not counting spots on fluoro units that means nothing. We need to speak to the clinical team. I know it's difficult for some people. We need to speak to the clinical guys about what really matters. We had a recent example with a cardiologist, and he was very upset with his image quality. And the thing that really upset him was that he needed to see the edge of the first rib. That's one of his safety margins. And he couldn't see the edge very well. So what did we do? The first thing, turn the edge enhancement up. Suddenly that improves them a bunch. There are other things that can be done as well. But we really need to speak to them about what they're actually trying to see. Not just measuring a CNR that goes up as the dose goes up, because we know that goes up when the dose goes. But looking at what are the limiting factors on their image quality, and then how do we measure those things? And that's going to mean engaging with clinicians to set meaningful targets. It's probably going to mean engaging with academics to look at ways that we can measure those, because we're going to have to use machine learning. We've already had mention about AI that's getting damn close to being able to report mammograms on its own. It would be incredibly arrogant of us as physicists to say that we can't use AI to do things like tell us how well an edge of a rib is imaged. There is space there, but we're going to need to engage with other people. And we're going to need some sort of platform, probably, to put these things on. It might be an extension to existing platforms, but some way that we can share these, because my goodness, we can't develop these all individually. And for all of the things that I've mentioned so far, what we really need to be doing is engaging more with the clinical users and with the manufacturers. The amount of grumbles I hear from the manufacturers about physics asking incredibly complicated questions to their app specialists, who are by and large radiographers and can't answer physics questions. The amount of grumbles I hear from physicists that, well, I've emailed the clinician twice and they've not replied to me. Clinicians don't work on email. They don't sit in front of a computer all day. Most of them are dealing face-to-face with people or on the phone. We need to engage with them in the way that they want to be engaged with, because otherwise they're not going to be reachable. But more important than that is about building trust. Engagement comes from trust, and trust comes from positive experiences. If we're a group that goes around wagging fingers at them for losing dose badges and telling them off for, you know, not following procedures that someone wrote and filed in a cupboard somewhere, that builds disengagement, right? We need to give them positive experiences. We need to help them with their problems to build positive engagement and build trust. It's the same with the manufacturers. If we're seen as an obstacle to getting equipment into clinical use because we're doing tests for days, having rolled up, not thought about it at all, turned up on the Monday with a copy of IPEM 91 saying, how do I make it do this? And they say, well, it doesn't, because that's not how it works. And then there's a whole bunch of fuss and fiasco, right? That builds negative experiences, disengagement. We don't get any help from them. They've already said, at least a couple of them, if we want to speak to their specialists, their physicists that develop equipment, we can. We just need to pay for it. If you're dropping £500,000 on a new intervention room, it really shouldn't be much to get physics a few hours with their specialists to really understand how the equipment works and build that into the procurement process. So we need to think about who we're talking to and make sure that we are, firstly, speaking to them in the way that they want to be spoken to, so using the phone or going and visiting them instead of just sending emails to people. We need to be consistent with the messaging that we send people, both within our individual teams, because there's nothing worse than having one person in a team give one answer and then the next person giving a completely different answer to the same question, but also broadly as a community, trying to actually say the same things to the manufacturers about what we want from them. And we want to set clear expectations. So it might be when you are buying equipment that you actually set out with the manufacturers, okay, you know, this is what we would like to get from meeting with your clinical specialist, this is what we'd like to get to meet with your physics specialists, and then apps are going to be doing something else. And it goes both ways, that we know, everyone knows where they stand. And so the idea is that this vision is going to form the sort of roadmap for the work of DRCIG over the next few years, and that each of the needs that I've just mentioned and that are laid out in that scope article are initially assessed by very short, sharp, I'm talking weeks, not months, or heaven forbid years like normal IPEN projects, weeks to do a task and finish group that says, what's the need we've addressed? Where is there missing evidence, like Debbie's alluded to already, right? And what do we need to fill that gap? And then you stop, and that project is done there and handed off to a longer term project to say, okay, now let's fill that need by going and collating that evidence and finding those missing things or building those tools or building that sharing platform or whatever it is that we identify. So I'm going to end with a call to action for all of you, the senior ones amongst you. I think you really need to think about how you can contribute to those first groups about setting objectives for what things might look like in a decade's time. And these shouldn't be massive, arduous projects. These should be quite short-term things. And then the more junior people who've got a bit more time and maybe want to build their networks and build their skills, I would ask you guys to seriously think about getting involved in one of the longer-term projects to help develop those things that we need and move things along so that in 10 years' time, we're not still talking about the tests that we don't think we should be doing or the things that we would really like to spend our time doing.